Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting. This is the City of Arroyo Grande for Tuesday, December the 11th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Ray is absent. Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes, here.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Here. Item three is our flag salute, and we're very pleased to have the El Camino 4-H group here this evening to do our flag salute. If you would please remain standing for invocation, Pastor Robert Banker from the Open Door Church.
Again, our Father in heaven, we lift up our hearts and thoughts unto you again today. We thank you for the privilege and opportunity to call upon you. We thank you that you are concerned about the affairs of men. And Father, we're thankful for the council as they share of their time for the affairs of the city. And Father, we pray that you would bless them, give them strength, reward them for their faithfulness. This we ask in our Savior's name. Amen.
Okay, somebody tipped you guys off because you're not leaving. You're staying up here, and that's a good thing because we get to hear about the 4-H group and some of the activities that you're involved in.
Hi, I'm Grace Ann Garza. I'm in the El Camino 4-H group. This is my sixth year. I'm Shadi. This is my sixth year in 4-H with El Camino, and I'm in the public speaking group and the rabbit group, and I'm also the treasurer for the club.
Okay, is that it? Nothing about the animals?
Okay. I like doing 4-H because it's like having the experience of working with these animals that is really interesting, and that's why I like doing pigs.
I like doing rabbits because I learn more about the anatomy, and it helps with human anatomy, I guess, so I learn more and more each day.
I'm in 4-H because I really like doing the public speaking because it just helps me, being able to, like, talk to an audience better and knowing, like, what I'm supposed to say and, like, how I'm supposed to say everything.
Okay, well, very good. Well, we appreciate you being here this evening, and we hope you'll come back and do our flag salute for us again. Would you consider that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Test, test.
Testing, test. Okay. We'll go over there and pick up the pieces after the meeting. All right, moving on in our agenda, item five is agenda review. 5A is our closed session announcements. On Tuesday, November 27th, the council met in closed session. We discussed real property issues as well as labor issues. The council took no only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Item 6, special presentations. We have none this evening. Item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any formal action on matters not published on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Please address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward, community comments and suggestions.
Good evening, council members and mayor. My name is David Broadwater. I drove down from Atascadero, and I'm sorry for the interruption earlier, but I got stuck in a huge traffic jam after an accident south of San Luis. I emailed you and have brought copies for all the members. I see that you have received those. I've been involved in the issue of sewage sludge land application in the county since 1990. About the plant dumping sewage sludge directly on the soil surface at the plant and with the potential for groundwater contamination. It's about 45 yards north of Arroyo Grande Creek. And so on the 3rd of this month, I went down to the Levee Creek area in between the sewage sludge storage area and the creek and took some photos and then took some additional photos from inside the plant. And you can see from these photos, especially the one on the third page, that the sewage sludge is mingling with standing water directly on the soil. I have spoken with the EPA, the regional board, the consultant who, the EPA consultant who did the inspection, Bob Barlogio, the plant manager, and went to the Sanitation District Board directors meeting on the 5th. There is discussion of a complicated process of pouring a concrete pad with a drainage for the leachate to, and there's also one of the things that's happening now, of course. Underneath, there's a chute coming out up of an auger out of the centrifuge building, which is a building that you can see in these photos, and just parking a truck there, and possibly if the 16 to 18 tons is too large of a load because of the soil surface there, having it hauled out 2 to 3 times a week instead of just once a week as a way to at least immediately stop that sewage sludge from being dumped directly on the soil surface, which is, I strongly recommend that as a as an interim step, you know, depending upon what other steps you may take later on. I'll be speaking with the other two agencies, the Oceano CSD and the Grover Beach City Council as well, since you're the three agencies that, that use this particular facility. But it's a potential problem. The John Wallace, the district administrator, at the board of directors meeting for the sanitation district said, after one of the board members read the permit that said that the sewage sludge should be stored on the drying beds at the plant, which are west. So I don't know what that interpretation would actually permit, but I don't, to me that doesn't sound like it's going to pass the smell test. So I urge your body to pay close attention to this and do what you can to make sure that the sewage sludge is taken off the ground as quickly as possible, and then look towards future long-term, more complicated and expensive solutions down the road. Thank you. I can answer any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
My name is Brad Snook. I'm the chair of our county's chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. I want to thank Dave for coming down from Atascadero. He knows more about sludge than anybody else that I know. So a strong environmental advocate and also a professional and an expert on this topic. Regarding the sanitation district, we've had a rocky 18 months, almost 2 years. We're optimistic that that the plant that was that went online in the mid 60s will be able to start planning for not only changes in the organization of the management of the plant, but also changes in the plant itself, and start having real discussions about water recycling and utilizing recycled water. Either here in our district, the three cities, Oceano and Grover Beach and AG, but potentially exporting that up to Napomo. 2012 was a big year because the voters up in Napomo shot down the pipeline. Chapter thinks is a bad idea. Santa Maria already imports state water project resources to turn around and sell resources to another community that doesn't import. Is a ridiculous solution. So since we're just dumping our water into the ocean, might as well use it up on the Mesa. In January, the Coastal Commission will be having their meeting in Pismo Beach. Chocado Farm. So forth. Also, the Pismo seawall issue is a real issue for Surfrider because seawalls act as permanent barriers, and eventually the wave action will erode away the beach. So whenever you have a seawall in place, the beach will eventually disappear as the sea level rises. And we all know that sea level rise is a real problem and will be a problem in the near future. We're hoping that Pismo will move to a management plan instead of watching the cliffs fall away and building a seawall. They actually look at a more holistic approach, the same way cities like this manage their stormwater. They will manage their coastal erosion. So thank you for your time, and we look forward to a really good 2013.
Okay. Thank you, Brett. Anyone else?
Rami Craig. I lived on Tally Ho. And
anyone else? Community comments or suggestions? All right, seeing no one, we'll close public comment. And just for the benefit of the audience and here and at home and also the council, with regard to the issues at the sanitation plant, I'll be providing some additional information on that during council communication. All right, we're going to move on to item 8, which is the consent agenda. This is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion, unless there is an item on consent that a member of the council would like to pull for further discussion, clarification, or an independent action. This is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on items on consent. If you're following along on this evening's agenda, we will be addressing consent items 8A through 8I. So once again, I'd like to offer an opportunity for members of the public. If any of you would like to come forward on any of comment on the consent agenda. Bring this back to the council. What is the will of the council this evening? Any items to pull?
No, thank you.
All right, we have no items from the consent agenda to pull, so I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda, items 8A through 8I.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Tim, anything to read in there this evening?
No ordinances this evening, Mayor Farrar.
Okay, thank you very much. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes, thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to our first public hearing this evening, and that is agenda item 9A. This is a continued public hearing and consideration of development code amendment. Teresa, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Alder House is a senior assisted living facility that's been in operation for about 40 years. Currently, the facility contains 18 units, all single occupancy, and is licensed to accommodate up to 32 residents. The property is about 36,000 square feet in size and is zoned multifamily and very high density residential. The facility is located within an established residential neighborhood with medium density surrounding the site to the north and west, multiple family development to the south, and an office and residential development to the east. Adjacent to Alder House to the north are two smaller lots that the applicant owns, and those are shown, the other red and then the blue one. These two lots are zoned single-family residential and are developed with single-family homes. The Alder House property and these two smaller lots have a planned development overlay for the purpose of coordinating any future development. The overlay also allows flexibility in any development standards. So the will be removed to accommodate the expansion, while the property on the corner of Alder Street and Dodson Way will remain. I will defer to the applicant regarding any future plans for this particular lot, but I believe that they do want to do something with it that is associated with the facility. There are three applications required to allow for the expansion and remodel: a development code amendment to change the zoning of the adjacent lot from single-family residential to multifamily very high-density residential consistent with the general plan, a conditional use permit for the physical improvements, and then a lot merger to combine the two lots. So the project meets development code requirements for the multifamily very high density residential zoning district, except for one of the side yard setbacks. The code requires a 10-foot setback and proposed is 6 feet. The planned development overlay allows variations from minimum requirements, with the finding that such a variation will produce a more desirable and livable community than the strict compliance with development code standards. In this the additional units and the amenities for the project to remain, and adhering to this stricter setback standard would impede the overall project design. Regarding density, the development code allows 34 dwelling units per acre for assisted living arrangements. So with over a little over an acre, they are allowed to have up to 35 units, and 27 units are proposed. This slide shows the proposed expansion in the dark blue shaded gray. In total, the addition will provide 4,454 square feet, of new space for the facility. The added parking is shown on the adjacent lot right above. Issues discussed in the staff report include aesthetics, parking, stormwater management, encroachments, and undergrounding of utilities. Regarding aesthetics, the architectural design of the facility is intended to blend with the surrounding residential neighborhood by maintaining the single-story form and matching the architectural style of the existing building. Cedar tree located in the front that is in poor condition. As recommended by the Planning Commission, they want to see an arborist report on that cedar tree, and an arborist report did come in recommending that it be removed because it is in very poor condition. Three coastlife oak trees are shown on the landscape plan as mitigation for a large oak that split and failed and had to be removed a couple of years ago. The landscape plan also includes shrubs that are specifically selected in height and density to screen headlights from the parking area that's proposed. Regarding parking, there have been complaints from neighbors over time about Alder House employees parking on the street. The project includes five spaces above development code requirements, so this really should alleviate the situation. However, the Planning Commission recommended that a condition be added to encourage employees to park on site. In response, staff has added a condition that requires the applicant to submit a program to encourage employees to park on site. The stricter alternative of requiring staff to park on site is and then also a small detention basin on the southwest portion of the property. Both of these facilities are shown on the plans, and a maintenance agreement is required for these facilities to ensure that they are maintained over time. There are two encroachments. As you can see on the slide, from the adjacent property to the east, but this situation is considered existing, non-conforming, and is not really an issue with this proposed development. The primary reason why the project was originally continued was to obtain more complete information about the undergrounding of overhead utilities. The development code requires new development to either place existing overhead utilities underground or pay an in-lieu fee. In this case, the in-lieu fee would be about $62,176 based on $232 per linear foot of frontage, and that is all the way up to Dotson Way, that calculation. This slide that you see here shows the five poles and the overhead utility lines. Four. Undergrounding telephone lines from pole 1 to pole 5. Undergrounding telephone and cable services from pole 4 across Alder Street and then north in a common trench to pole 5. Bringing the cabling up poles 1 and 5 to continue overhead service west down Ash Street and north across Dodson Way and up Alder Street. It is assumed that pole boxes will be necessary at most of the pole locations, and that two direct bores will go across Alder Street instead of saw cutting the road, which was just overlaid in September. The applicant submitted a letter requesting that an in-lieu fee be paid based on the estimated cost of physically placing the utilities underground. And their submitted cost estimates have varied, but staff believes the $152,271 that was estimated in the staff report is reasonable. As of today, the applicant submitted a revised estimate of $254,673, which is an increase of over $100,000. adoption will just take more time, and we cannot do that today. The development code provides several circumstances in which the city can justify payment of an in-lieu fee instead of physically requiring the undergrounding of utilities. For this project, an in-lieu fee can be justified since the project provides additional housing units for people with special needs. However, staff recommends that the utilities be placed underground in conformance with the development code for two reasons. First, removal of the existing poles and overhead lines is relatively simple because they only provide communication and not electrical service. And second, it is unlikely that this residential neighborhood will have the opportunity to underground overhead utilities in the near future, since this neighborhood is already well established and there is little subdivision opportunity that would require any undergrounding. The city also prioritizes commercial districts for its undergrounding efforts when where the right-of-way is extensively used by the general public and carries a heavier volume of pedestrian and vehicular traffic. So therefore, allowing an in-lieu fee instead that council first introduced an ordinance amending the zoning map to designate the property located at 279 Alder Street as multifamily, very high density residential, and second, adopt a resolution approving the conditional use permit and lot merger to expand and remodel the existing Alder House assisted living facility. As alternatives, council can introduce the ordinance to amend the zoning map as proposed, modify the conditions of approval, and then adopt a resolution approving the project, or not introduce the ordinance or approve the project, or provide other direction to staff. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Questions for Kelly? Go
ahead. A few things. The in-lieu fee at $232 per, I think it was linear foot. I'm getting old and forgetful. Can you remind me how that number was arrived at?
The ordinance was put in place several years ago. I don't have the methodology.
Time, so it may be outdated at that time, but we came up with some actual estimates at the time of what the cost would be per.
Well, that was the root of my question. I guess, does it need to be updated?
Sounds like it. Yeah, the cost, I know in working with undergrounding project on Grand Avenue that the cost for undergrounding have escalated very substantially over the past few years.
I don't think it's reasonable if it's not a, if the fee's not in line with the actual costs, then that needs to be revisited as well. Second question I have is, did the applicant come forward with the revised estimate after staff recommended that they would underground?
Yes, we got an email this morning that had a revised estimate of the cost to underground the utilities. And
any idea when they knew what your recommendation was going to be?
Well, they knew it by the virtue of the staff report.
When was that?
Well, I think they've known all the way along, through Planning Commission, that we require them to.
Situation and with up. Being on Planning Commission, I'm a person that likes to kind of be hands-on with maps, and I tend to process things better. Next time, is it possible for projects like this to get a copy of any kind of maps that might be part of the project, a physical map, put in my packet?
Yes, certainly, we can provide a hard copy of a larger-scale map if requested.
Great, thank you. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
If there are no other questions, this is a public hearing, and we typically allow the applicant or the applicant's representative to go first. Are you here? Okay, if you would please come forward and state your name, please.
Hi, my name's Todd Tosay from the Alder House, and along with my family, we've owned it for 21 years now. And thank you for allowing us to come before you and present our project. Some of you may remember that we've been here before and tried to present a project on the same site of a larger scale. When we tried to present that project, we thought it was one that worked. Leave our basic goal the same, which is to provide quality care for seniors in this area. And one thing that kind of struck me, the information that I know, but kind of struck me when I was looking at the slide, is if you paid attention to the slides that Kelly put up there, we're way under on density and on developing the project, because we want to have outside space for our residents to move around, get around. We want to have commodious accommodations. And we do want to address the concerns of parking that neighbors have brought before us. Now, in the time that we came, in that time since we last came, we've had some parking concerns of our own. One thing I brought up to the Planning Commission when we went before them was we had an elderly lady who was coming to visit her husband who lived there. And she was finding that she'd show up at some times and we wouldn't have enough parking for her. And nowhere. Our handicapped spot would be full, so she would have to park on the street. And she uses a wheelchair and try to get herself into the building. And I kind of vowed don't share the same concerns that the neighbors do as far as our employees parking on. It doesn't bother me because they park on the street also. But I've had employees have their cars keyed on the street. I had one employee have a car get broken into on the street. Well, I think it's a good neighborhood. I, too, want to get them back onto our property where it's lit and they can see, especially at night, since we are staffed 24 hours a day. Another thing I wanted to kind of point out is that we are adding 4,400 square feet onto an existing building. As such, it is accurate. We're building 9 rooms, but we're actually eliminating one in the process. So we're going to net 8 rooms in our project in a 4,400 square foot building. To do this, there's a lot of things that we look at as business owners. Obviously, the bottom line for our project is important to us. In looking at those kind of numbers, we've had some vague, mysterious numbers that we've tried to hammer out and get better ideas on, getting estimates on things, having subcontractors coming up with costs to find out things. As far as the undergrounding, the new bid's 250-something thousand. The old bid was 156,000 or something like that. In hashing out the numbers for our project, I can tell you that if the numbers for undergrounding came at 156,000 to underground the utilities, we can't afford that. That kills the project right there at 156,000. We're already at our budget max, and the latest estimate I had in talking to our architect was we were a little over budget without doing even the in-lieu fee. So I know you have the ability to hold us to that, to make us do the undergrounding. I'm asking that you don't do that. We have a wonderful residential neighborhood, but like Kelly Heffernan pointed out, there's little chance that the rest of it's gonna get underground. And doing a 100 or 150 foot section in front of our building really doesn't gain that much for the neighborhood. And I have to say that living here, I have noticed over the last few years improvements in our town. I've noticed it in some of the construction, some of the colors in buildings, and I do appreciate that. And we're willing to play ball on helping to improve the We've tried to scale down again to meet people's expectations of the neighborhood. And as such, we're getting the same demand to do the undergrounding that the large project would have had.
Was that it?
Yeah.
Any questions?
Just on the original $156,000 estimate, did you guys solicit that bid, or did that come from staff?
You'd have to talk to our architect. I don't remember. And he can come speak next. I'm not the numbers guy.
Well, maybe you can answer that question. He's right behind you there.
Oh. Good evening, Council. Kyle Harris, architect, Harris Architecture and Design. We worked closely with staff to develop that initial $156,000 estimate, working with AT&T, with Charter Cable, with my engineering firm, consultant Toma Electric. We came up with that $156,000 fee. One of the things that Todd mentioned is the tightness of our budget. Contractor take the plans and information that we've been given and actually put some hard numbers to those based on work that they've been doing in the area, actual work in the city of Arroyo Grande. That's where they came up with that $256,000 number. We could go down line item by line item, but suffice it to say that the main trunk cable for AT&T runs right down Alder Street. That's a 300-pair cable. It serves basically that whole part of that neighborhood, and undergrounding that, the cost for the cabling alone is very substantial.
Okay, I'm a little confused now. When you say 156, are we talking about the 152-271? I'm not seeing a 156 anywhere.
I may have misspoken that.
That's correct.
Well, I had a quick question, and that is, we have this information. Or have you?
We've been working with several entities. To back up, with PG&E, when we have a situation like this with them, they will come and give us an actual hard cost, correct? With AT&T and Charter Cable, they want you to enter into a contract so they can do the engineering work, and then they will give you their cost estimate. And so without entering into a contract with them, we don't get an absolute fixed number from them. So we've been working with contractors that have been doing this for AT&T and Charter Cable and have come up with these numbers. The initial number we came up with, again, was information that we got from AT&T, from Charter Cable, and from my consultant, Toma Electric. The information that we received yesterday was a confirmation of a bid, if you will, of what it would cost if we handed the plans to the contractor today and say, go build this.
Okay, so so then the work that AT&T and Charter would do, or is that in place of what they would do, or are they lumping additional work and costs on top of these two estimates?
There will be a fee. There will be an additional fee from AT&T and Charter Communication on top of the infrastructure numbers you have in front of you.
But we don't know what that is.
We don't know what that is. We don't know. We won't know until we enter into a contract with AT&T and Charter Communications as to what those fees will be.
I've got a couple of quick questions about the existing parking.
How many existing spaces are there on the facility right now before any improvements?
I think we've got the information on the slide here. On site, I believe we have 9. I believe we have 9 currently.
So you're adding 11.
Correct.
Going from 9 to 20, is that correct?
Sorry, Councilman Costello, we're just trying to estimate from the aerial. It looks to be close to 9. You could see the parking located there in front of the current facility
so,
in the aerial.
So there's a net increase of 11.
Correct.
Thank you.
I have some parking questions. Back to your issue, maybe you can come back to the podium as well. I'm trying to figure out how many employees do you have in a given shift, just roughly?
In a given shift, probably 6 on the biggest shift.
So that means 6 cars, you probably have 3 8-hour shifts or something to that effect?
3 hours, no, most of them are 8-hour shifts. I have some that are 5. But
what I'm saying is you'd have 6 cars times 3 8-hour shifts, so you'd have...
No, that would not be accurate. I have probably 6 cars during the day till 3 o'clock. Okay. From 3 o'clock until 11 o'clock at night, maybe 3 or 4, and then 2 overnight.
So you have a lot less in the evening.
When we came before the Planning Commission, that was the biggest concern, and also when we talked about doing a project a few years ago before the City Council.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, this is a public hearing. If there are others in the audience who would like to address 9A, this would be an opportunity. Once again, we'd like to we give extra time to the applicant. We would like you to keep your comments, if you would, brief, 3 minutes or less. Anyone who would like to come forward on 9A, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? No one? Okay. We'll close the public hearing portion of 9A, and we'll bring this back to the council, and we'll start with Councilmember Guthrie.
I've been watching this actually for years, from way back when we first adopted the general plan. I do think this is an excellent addition to our housing stock, if you will, in our area, because there is a clear need. There's going to be more need in the future. I do remember the other project as being much. A little bit different than talking about condos or homes or something. So I do think that given the scale of the current project that and given what you provide, that in fact this, well, you can't really say it's directly in scale with the neighborhood, is actually workable within this neighborhood. When you look at the 2 sets of courtyard homes in particular that are right next door and actually have much higher square footage density than this one does. So I'm comfortable with the building project itself. I'm comfortable with the parking. I did not hear address what would happen with the final parcel, how you would work that out in the long run, but we'll deal with that when it comes forward. So I think we're really down to the question of undergrounding or not. When I first read the staff report, my first inclination was to say that certainly we would settle for the in-lieu fee. Because here's one corner in the middle of a neighborhood that actually probably will not be undergrounded. But when you actually go to the corner here, because the 2 courtyard homes did underground, and you look down the street towards $70,000. I am now concerned about whether the 152.6, I guess why I think I'm the one that would start with the wrong number. The 152.6 versus $250,000, and then what I hear plus what AT&T might charge on top of that. There's something wrong with all of these numbers. But I think basically we're being told that even the 152.6 number would make this project unworkable. So I'm open to hearing from my other council members. I actually do think there's a benefit to the neighborhood to undergrounding here. This is not just one house being undergrounded. This is actually the completion of almost more than an entire block, and would add aesthetically to a neighborhood that is going to be impacted by this. At this kind of cost, $250,000, I actually would be inclined to offer the in-lieu fee and waive undergrounding, but I am concerned about suddenly being hit with a totally different number and about how accurate that is. So I'll leave that part of it. I'm open to go.
I too have seen this site multiple times since the year 2000 when I started on Planning Commission, and it is, like Jim said, a much better project, I think, with less resistance by the neighborhood than we've seen in the past. So in a lot of ways, I don't have issues with a majority of the project. I am a stickler regarding in-lieu fees because in-lieu fees never resolved an issue in my mind, ever. They never have, and they probably never will. And in this case, I think by my questioning with staff, I've come to the conclusion that the current in-lieu fee isn't in line with, proportionally with, the cost of undergrounding, if in fact the cost of undergrounding is as high as it seems to be. The in-lieu fee should be higher as well. So I understand Jim's point, Councilman Guthrie's point, regarding if it's 250 and it's going to kill the project or whatever, that maybe an in-lieu fee is possible. I personally can't vote for it at this point because I'm nervous about the numbers and how radically they changed in so quick a time. And I was going to bring up the issue. Number comes down, and you'd be willing to do it. You can't do it at 152, so my question would be, I think out loud is, okay, so what happens if it's 100? Would you then say, we still can't do it, or would you say, we can do it? So those are issues I'm thinking about in my head. We need a peer review to know what the actual costs are. But in the current status that it's at, I cannot and will not vote for it unless undergrounding is included. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I don't have a whole lot of information to add to what I've just heard from my colleagues. I agree with the project itself looks pretty good. The parking is an improvement. But we get back down to the undergrounding or not. And I too would like to see some review of the figures to verify them one way or the other, although I'll point out right now that if simply the 300 pair cable at 400 linear feet at $237 a linear foot in and of itself is almost $100,000. So if that's an accurate figure, I suspect that we're going to see that this myself.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think it's clear from the comments, at least from my colleagues, and certainly what's been on my mind listening to both the staff report and especially the applicant's testimony this evening, that we don't have enough information up here to resolve the undergrounding issue. The information that we had before we came in here obviously was the 152-271. And so, as Councilmember Guthrie pointed out, the decision was between an in-lieu fee of 62 or the actual cost for undergrounding as we perceived it at the time when we walked in here this evening at 152. Since then, in the last few minutes, we've received this information, which is over $250,000 to do this work. And then we've also heard that there's an additional fee that's going to be whether or not it's reasonable to move forward with a request to underground if it's within a reasonable range, or if it's way out in left field, then it might have a bearing on our final decision. as we sit here tonight, I think we have concurrence that the direction that we want to go in is undergrounding as many of the utilities in that area as we possibly can. This is an opportunity for us to continue on with that pattern. And I think my position would be, I think this is a good project. You know, I was out there, been out there a couple of times, and I think this project would fit into the neighborhood. That's not the issue. The parking seems to have been resolved. That's not the issue. The sticking point, once again, as everyone has indicated, is the utilities. And until we have a final figure on, what exactly it's going to cost to do that, so we have something valid to compare against what our existing court. My position right now would be without the undergrounding. Would be to either continue this or approve the project with the condition that the undergrounding take place and put the ball back in your court. So, I mean, those are the two options. And I think at this point I'm kind of leaning towards approving the project with a condition that it be undergrounded. And if it turns out that is not feasible at some point and you want to come back again, or I'm not sure what the process is, if we have better information, perhaps it can be brought back. Can we do that, Teresa?
Well, typically if we approved a project and then the applicant wished to change that condition, we would notice a public hearing again and bring it back in the same manner at a public hearing before you to consider that changed condition. And I think that would be the case here. I would just observe that on the project feasibility, and I think that's the case that the applicant is trying to make.
Yes, Mayor. I'd point out that the staff report we have says the development code provides the following circumstances in which the city can justify payment of an in-lieu fee instead of physically requiring the undergrounding. And the only one that applies here is point four, which is upon the recommendation from the community development director that such requirement for undergrounding would be detrimental to economic development, affordable housing, or the provision of other public amenities or benefits. And absent that, and I don't think I've heard the community development director recommend that this be waived, or am I mistaken?
Based on the analysis in the staff report, given the utilities in the neighborhood and the points outlined by Kelly, at this point in time, we were not recommending that the undergrounding be waived, certainly not be waived. The in-lieu fee is a separate consideration, but the staff recommendation is to underground the utilities.
Mr. Mayor, I'd suggest that I'd probably support your position that we approve this with the
But I think if you include it in your motion that you would open that door for them to come back without fee, then we can certainly do that.
And let me pose a hypothetical. If you want to deny to not respond, that's fine. If in fact the estimate had come back at $250,000, would your recommendation still be to require undergrounding?
Well, I think in balancing, you know, the considerations of a project, this is for an assisted living facility, as you stated. It does serve, you know, one of our general plan purposes to provide that special needs housing. And in consideration that we must make sure that the conditions imposed upon the project are proportional to the project, that may indeed, you know, weigh into a consideration and whether or not that's an appropriate condition.
So I guess I'd say I am inclined to support the idea of moving forward so that we leave. Projects to compare. We have Grand Avenue and we have a residential area project in which I think we can probably come up with a more appropriate number. I understand it's not retroactive, but it still is something that we need to do going forward. So I would like to see us actually go forward, approve the project without the waiving the in-lieu fee, requiring the undergrounding, and let's come back with some real numbers and see where it is.
Is that a motion?
I have a quick question, and I would hope that in your motion, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I can't get away with leaning backwards anymore. Jim just said we can't retroactively increase the in-lieu fee, basically, because we don't have any new information. But what I'm concerned, we keep talking about proportional fairness. What I'm trying, we're approving a project at given numbers right now at 150. It would seem to me that if they come back at a later date, fee, because I don't think the in-lieu fee matches by any stretch of the imagination, based on staff's own comments, what the actual cost proportionally is for undergrounding, and it should be some proportional amount, I think, and I think that was the intent when it was done.
They're subject to the fee that's in place at the time they submit their application and that it's approved for processing. So as long as you're dealing with this application, we wouldn't be able to change any of our impact fees and impose them on this project. If the project was denied and resubmitted, and during that time period we revisited and increased the fee, then it would apply. But that's going to take a while.
And I'll add that I think that would be fundamentally unfair that the project was put together under certain conditions.
I understand.
I'm prepared to move forward and adopt I believe there's one ordinance and a resolution that we would have to adopt.
There's three motions altogether.
Are there three of them? All right.
Isn't there a lot merger?
Subject property as multiple family, very high density residential, development code amendment 12-002 applied for by the city of Arroyo Grande for the property located at 279 Alder Street.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All right, discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Farrar?
Yes.
And I'll move a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adopting a mitigated negative declaration instructing the city clerk to file a notice of determination approving conditional use permit 12-001 and lot merger 12-001 for property located at 279 and 295 Alder Street, applied for by Todd Toves Alder House.
All right. There's a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that also.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay, thank you. We're going to move on now to continued business. 10A is adoption of an urgency ordinance authorizing an amendment to the contract between the City of Arroyo Grande and CalPERS. Angie, good evening.
Good evening. Before you this evening is an urgency ordinance amending the California Public Employees Retirement System contract to implement a two-tiered PERS plan for the Arroyo Grande local miscellaneous employees. The reason this is being presented tonight as an urgency ordinance is due to the adoption of AB 340, the Public Employee Pension Reform Act of 2013. AB 340 establishes a new retirement formula that will apply to new employees hired after January 1st, 2013. AB 340. Contract with CalPERS to establish the second tier. The second tier will implement the 2% at 55 three-year final compensation PERS plan. The adoption of this urgency ordinance will implement the provisions of the current MOU with the Service Employees International Union and the Arroyo Grande Police Officers Association and will take effect on December 21st, 2012. The employer contribution rate for current miscellaneous members is 22.086. The employer contribution rate for the second tier will be 9.716, which is over a 12% decrease. Beginning January 1st, 2013, a three-tier system will be in place. Existing employees will remain under the 2.5 at 55 plans. New employees hired from another CalPERS agency will be under the 2% at 55 plan, and all other employees will be under the AB 340 plan, which is 2% at 62. That completes my report. I'm ready for any questions.
Questions? Okay, this is not a public hearing, but it is a business item, and if there's anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and comment on this, this would be an opportunity. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we'll come back and see what the council has to say. We'll start with Councilmember Brown.
I'm fine and ready to approve.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie?
Yeah, I can see this is just, you know, sort of housekeeping that we need to comply with the state here, and it's a good move as well.
Mayor Pro Tem?
I will also support this tonight.
All right. Not much we can, I can add to that. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move approval of an urgency ordinance of the City City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande authorizing amendment of the contract between the City of Arroyo Grande and the Board of Administration of the California Public Employees Retirement System for local miscellaneous members.
All right. We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
And a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. Before you guys get too comfortable, Mike, let me ask the question. How many of you are here to speak to the speed survey? Okay. Is there any way that, are you up against a time crunch, or can we take one more item? And the reason why is because Councilmember Ray had an unavoidable delay at work. She wanted to be here for this so that she could participate. And so I'd like to have one more, maybe perhaps do one more item and then come back to this. We expect her at any moment. So if you could be a little patient, we'll go ahead and move to 11B. Sorry about that, guys. And then we'll come back to 11A. And this is consideration of a resolution adopting the 2013 update of the multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan. Chief, good evening.
The consideration before you tonight is the adoption or the resolution to adopt the resolution to update the multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan. The previous plan was adopted by the Arroyo Grande City Council in 2007, which in turn was approved by the Federal Emergency Management Agency in 2008. The Disaster Mitigation Act requires all local hazard mitigation plans to be updated each 5 years. The 2007 local hazard mitigation plan included the cities of Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach and the Lucia Mar Unified School District. This year's updated plan includes those three and also the South County Sanitation District. Highlights of this plan specific to Arroyo Grande are the possible expansion of various retention basins, improvements to the Tallyho Creek to reduce potential of flooding, the identification and public notification of seismically vulnerable structures, continuance of wildland and urban interface fuel reduction and weed abatement programs, and a creation of a community evacuation plan along with the exercise of that plan. Grover Beach has adopted this plan in their portion on November 19th of this year. The Sanitation District was presented with the plan on November 7th of this year. And I believe it's on their agenda to be approved at December 19th meeting. Lucia Mar has yet to place this plan on their agenda. Once all jurisdictions have adopted the plan, the authority will submit this to CalEMA for their approval, and then it will go on to FEMA for their final approval. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions.
Any questions for the chief?
Well, sort of a question, if you can. When I sat in at the Sand District here, this is actually a fairly scaled down version from the previous one, and I'll just make the comment that was actually kind of the direction of the federal government that last time we went and described every possible hazard, and instead this time it's only the probable ones, which makes it much more readable document.
Correct. These that we have identified are the what I'll call the natural disasters, only disasters that are likely to occur to our specific community.
Okay, just a kind of a clarification. The I don't know if you looked at the hazard mitigation plan or the emergency plan, but the emergency plan hazard analysis goes into more depth than this does. So I don't know which of the two that you saw previously.
I believe this was presented as a draft document at the Sand District a month ago.
Correct.
It's the same, and at that point they made the point that they'd been given direction by FEMA, whoever the federal is, that it was the last one was overdone and that this is okay. Only deals with those likely.
All right. Once again, this is not a public hearing. If anyone would like to comment on our hazard mitigation plan draft, this would be an opportunity. Anyone?
My name is Aaron Denham. I live on 366 Tally Ho, and my backyard is that creek right there. And I just wonder, I didn't get any information about that part, what you guys are talking about. I don't know where the water comes from or goes. Mostly it's just a runoff, and what the hazards would be. Just regular ground contamination? Can anybody answer that?
It deals with flooding. And what the plan will address is a study of cost to benefit ratio to reduce the amount of flooding that occurs because of Tally Ho.
Okay. Well, I weed abate my own property right there. Sometimes the prisoners come down and do it. This last 2 months ago, they came down and they only did one part of it, like. The thing's probably, say, 25 feet wide. They probably did about 10 feet, and they said that most of the growth could be up to 18 inches. That's what a lady told me. I usually keep it at ground level to keep it from flooding. We've been cleaning it out. I get the letters from FEMA. They've come out, did the studies. We had the red-legged frog issue. We haven't had any of the same. It always changes every year, and this is kind of like a new item for me. We're here for the enforcement of the road thing, and I didn't know anything about the flooding issue of that. So how do I get more paperwork to find out about what they're going to start doing now?
You can call our office, and we'll be happy to sit down with you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one, we'll bring this back to the council, and we'll start with Councilmember Ray.
Pardon me, I'm sick, so if I'm having trouble being heard or coughing, I apologize. Yeah, go this way. Well, I was the one of us who worked on this document with Dave Matthey, and so I'm very familiar with it, and I think I can maybe give a little bit of light to this that that indeed Councilman Guthrie is correct, that FEMA basically looked at our last one and the last one of everyone and determined that their direction was, there was so much in the old report that had to do with the history of the area, including when the stagecoaches were here, that really didn't have a whole lot to do with actual hazard mitigation, and that the plan really focuses upon not only our hazards, but the ability for us to get federal funding to mitigate those hazards. And so it's not really meant to deal with everyday hazards, but ones that we as a city can plan for and mitigate for and apply for federal funds to do that. It's a very well-researched document. Dave did an amazing job at putting this document together. So even though he's not here tonight, I just want to give thanks to him for his expertise. The level of expertise that he brought to this plan is really exemplary. So that put me in an admirable position of mostly being a proofreader and making sure that all of our city resources got into this document. So with that, I'll say that I have great confidence in this plan at all the amount of eyes that have looked at the plan, and now with this group looking at it too, I'll certainly be able to support this tonight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Brown?
Nothing to add. I'm ready for approval.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, you can support it.
Mayor Pro Tem?
Well, I'd like to echo some of the comments that Councilmember Ray put forward here. I have a lot to do with mitigation in my professional life. Federal government in the year 2000 changed their focus away from response and repetitive disasters to mitigation, and has been working the past 12 years to get local jurisdictions to do exactly this. I've been watching this document grow for the past 2 years out of the original document from several years ago, and this is an excellent, excellent piece of work. Getting it approved puts us in line to be able to apply for federal mitigation dollars. Some of the projects we've done in the past have included the wildland fire interface, where we took some of the fuel out on James Way. wherever we can identify specific hazards to the community, as we've done in this document, from flooding or earthquake hazards or fire hazards, and can identify actions that we can take that are going to cost dollars to do, now we can bid for some of the federal dollars to get those things done. So I don't know that it's the question you as a member of the public asked. That's okay. It is a very good thing. We actually have the potential to mitigate against problems like that. This will open the door to our getting our hands on federal dollars. So I'll wholeheartedly support this, and I also want to congratulate the department for the work it's done, and particularly for that what Dave Matthew did. This is a very good document, and I will happily support it tonight.
Okay, thank you. I don't have much to add. This was challenging because, as we've discussed, it is multi-jurisdictional, and so not only did it have to be comprehensive for each political subdivision here in South County, but we had to make sure that each of those hazard mitigation subsections that deal with specific agencies were did not conflict, but instead enhanced each other. In other words, they had to kind of speak to one another. The same information had to be consistent throughout each of the plans, particularly when we talk about a flood and things of that nature. That doesn't floods tend not to honor city boundaries. So we have to make sure that all of those subsets of this plan talk to one another. And I wanted to thank the chief and especially Dave Matthew for being patient with us, because we had a last minute change with the sanitation district. We added another objective, and Dave was kind enough to integrate it into the draft, and that's one of the reasons why you kind of got a second version of the multi-jurisdictional plan. But thanks for the time and the effort in putting forward a real professional piece of work. So I'm enthusiastically in support of this. So, Karen, I'm going to turn to you for the motion. So,
get to the right spot. Mr. Mayor, I move that we approve the resolution adopting the 2013 update of the multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan.
Seconded.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to go back to 11A, and this is consideration for adoption of the 5-year radar speed survey for selected city streets.
Good evening again, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Tonight we'll have a short presentation for you for the this year's speed survey, and we're going to start off with Chief Anibali, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about needs for enforcement, and then we'll follow up with Mike Lind to talk about the a survey conducted on the streets, and then conclude. Chief.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, and everyone in attendance tonight. I just wanted to start this topic with a little discussion about some traffic enforcement issues in the Coral Grande Police Department. Mostly speak of what our traffic enforcement assets are, and then also some of our plans or action plans for some of the areas that are in question. So with that, I'd like to move to the next slide. The Oro Grande Police Department began quite a while ago to prepare to be a top-notch traffic enforcement police department, and we have a variety of things at our disposal. It's important for everyone to know. First, in the area of public education, we have a variety of signage. We have some unique signage. If you see up there, we have a thing called traffic enforcement here, and then it says day of the week, and I'll explain that in a moment. We also have received a grant and have a large digital electronic display board that we can use for public education and traffic. And again, I'll talk about that, how we're going to use that on Grace Lane and Tally Ho in a moment. We also have a series of technologies that we've put into the department over the past 4 years. Each patrol vehicle is equipped with state-of-the-art Stalker 2. They're called radar. That's the one on the right that can track radar and vehicles approaching from the front and the rear. That's in our patrol vehicles. And also, the motor officers not only have the Stalker radar, but they also have LIDAR, laser radar, and which is on the left there. And we do our enforcement from both motorcycle, and we have two motorcycles, and we also have all patrol vehicles have the capability to be traffic enforcement vehicles also with radar. All our officers have been trained, except the brand new ones that just have come on, with the ability to run radar anywhere within the city. So definitely capable both technology-wise and public education. Let me tell you a little bit about that sign on the left up there, just because it's one of our favorites. We have not deployed those yet, but we're looking forward to do that soon after the speed surveys are done. The idea behind these signs is they go in pairs into neighborhoods and before traffic enforcement is happening. And I know it sounds unusual to actually tell residents, but it will say on their traffic enforcement here, let's say, Friday, and we'll put them out days before the enforcement day. Now, that doesn't mean there's no chance of getting a ticket. It's just letting them know that's the day we're going to be there. Then on the day before, Thursday night, let's say, we remove the signs and do very concentrated enforcement on that Friday. Now, you're probably asking yourself, well, if you're telling them when you're going to be there, how do they know not to speed? For every time we put those out, there's going to be, once they get comfortable with those signs, there's going to be a day where they go by and see the signs, and it's going to say, as it says there, today. And by the time they see the sign, if they're a violator, it's already too late. The idea behind it is you can move these three sets of signs throughout the city, coupled with your traffic enforcement, and it gives kind of a force multiplier. When people see those signs anywhere, they don't know if it's going to say today on the sign or if it's going to say Friday. And so that helps educate the public, but also keeps us out and very visible as far as traffic enforcement. If we can go to the next slide. Let me give you a little background on some traffic enforcement that we may not be familiar with, and the public may not be. In early 2008, our traffic and engineering surveys of the streets began to expire. The five-year surveys that we need to establish speed limits began to expire throughout the city. And in the first quarter of 2008, the traffic commissioner, which is like a judge, traffic judge, dismissed citations, one in particular on Tally Ho, and declared that Tally Ho was a speed trap by the definition of the vehicle code. The reason for that is we did not have a current speed survey justifying the speed that was posted there, and the vehicle code does not allow you to enforce if you do not have that. It's considered a speed trap, which I'll explain in a moment. So the judge dismissed that ticket, and if I recall correctly, during that time, there were 16 written that week on Tally Ho, and then directed our department to no longer enforce posted speed limits in any area that did not have the speed surveys completed that justified the speed, which is, you'll hear, the 85th percentile rule. So a little bit what a speed trap is for people that don't know what that is, and I sure don't want to read all the vehicle code to you, but let me go to the subsection 2 there that's probably important, and bear with me here. It says, a particular section of highway with a prima facie speed limit that is provided by this code or by local ordinance under subparagraph, a lot of numbers, and here's the important part, if that prima facie speed limit is not justified by an engineering and traffic survey conducted within 5 years prior to the date of the alleged violation, and enforcement of the speed limit involves the use of radar, as we've talked about, and any other electronic device that measures the speed of moving objects, that would be declared a speed trap, and that's what the judge based his ruling on. So why is it that we can't enforce? Again, in the vehicle code, it says in 40803A, no evidence as to the speed of a vehicle upon a highway shall be admitted in any court upon the trial of any person in any prosecution under this code upon a charge involving the speed of a vehicle when the evidence is based upon or obtained from or by the maintenance or use of a speed trap. So you can see right away that once we were in the definition of a speed trap, it really limited us from doing any enforcement there. And in fact, it goes on a little more, because I know a question came up at the Traffic Commission's suggesting that, well, we should still enforce it. And the next section kind of explains why we would not do that. 40804A, in any prosecution under this code upon a charge involving the speed of a vehicle, an officer or other person shall be incompetent as a witness if the testimony is based upon or obtained from or by the maintenance or use of a speed trap. So hopefully that explains a little bit why we're in such a position where on any street that was required to have a survey, we cannot currently enforce, and the judge's concern specifically about Tally Ho being a speed trap. So let me, last couple things I want to say before we move into the more details of this, and that is establishing realistic speed limits. It's just a couple of things. This is a very common topic. I think throughout my career I've probably done 5 or 6 of these presentations when these things happen, and they always happen in every community. There's concerns that I understand from the public about speed in their neighborhoods, and it's sometimes hard to understand that by placing speed limits too low and getting in a position where we can't enforce, that is not the answer either. So a couple of things to remember about establishing realistic speed limits, and that is the use of the vehicle speed data as one of the factors evaluated for selecting a suitable speed limit is based on the following fundamental concepts deeply rooted in the United States system of government. Second, laws are established for the protection of the public and the regulation of unreasonable behavior of a few individuals. And I think when you see the details of some of those speed surveys, you'll realize, yes, there are people definitely speeding at very high speeds on some of these streets, but they are the few individuals, and we're looking forward to the opportunity to do the enforcement. Next, the normally careful and competent actions of reasonable persons should be considered legal. And I think that's what we're going to be talking about when we talk about that 85th percentile. And I'll leave you with the most drivers are reasonable people who will drive carefully at the speed which is suitable for existing conditions. And that is exactly what these surveys bring forward. If I go to the next slide, just some things to think about if you establish a too low of speed limit. And I know a lot of people will think, why would our police chief ever be up here talking about having too low of speed limits? But it's really important to understand how this works to give us the tools to enforce. First, if you establish too low of a speed limit, the vast majority of all people are going to be violators there, because the speed limit is just too low for what the conditions are. We all know that if we were driving on a all of us then would be violators of that speed if that was set too low. Again, the other thing, if enforced, causes antagonism towards enforcement personnel and traffic laws in general. Once people feel like that's an unrealistic speed limit, their ability to follow it is very limited, and we can do all the enforcement we want, but just pushing it down to an unrealistic speed limit is very difficult. Of course, it creates a bad image for the community. And the last but not least, it results in speed differentials in the traffic flow. And the example I would give you, we've all been on a street somewhere, whatever that speed limit is, and have someone in front of us driving incredibly slow, below the speed limit. And we all know what that can contribute to. It impedes the flow of traffic, has differentials in the speed as far as the traffic flow, and many times actually leads to some erratic driving on the people's part as they try to get around the person that's driving at an unreasonable speed. Of course, if none of the speeds are actually approved by the survey where we can do any enforcement, what good is it to have a lower speed limit? We have a lower speed limit that I can't enforce. I can never go out and may think those speeds might be too much, but it'll allow us to go out and enforce the people that are seriously in violation, not the people within 5 miles per hour. I go to the next slide. I get last slide before we go into the actual survey. One more. There we go. Let me tell you a little bit about our action plan, not only the council, but of course the residents that are out here. And I'm sorry to have my back to you, but we only have so many seats out there. First, we have a specific plan for Grace Lane and Tally Ho. We've met with my commander in charge of patrol services, who is a former motor officer, I will tell you. And when you start talking traffic, he gets very happy. And so we have a specific plan we have for Grace Lane and Tally Ho. First, once we have these justified speed limits in place where we can actually go out and do the enforcement, and they're posted, and I've been talking with our new public works director right in the back room here now to make sure we get those posted right away. Our plan is first to place our radar trailer out there to do monitoring of the where we're at. Of course, we have the speed survey also. Second, we want to do that public education we talked about, a combination of those signs and billboard signs. I have no problem whatsoever going right out and posting those things and letting people know we're going to be here doing traffic enforcement. And it may even be in the middle of the day why those signs are there. You never know when that's going to happen. So it's kind of a shell game. So we definitely want to do some public education, and that's our plan. Third, and these things can happen pretty quick, so you don't think that it's going to be multiple days before this happens. Third, we're going to remove that signage and do a very focused campaign on traffic enforcement on these streets. We have plans already for motor officers, including our second motor officer that works part-time motor officer, come in to work that, along with our patrol officers who all, like I said, have radar in their vehicles and are all certified in radar. And if you checked with a number of other police agencies, they don't have that capability in every car. We do. And so we're looking forward to do that. And we would do a very concentrated campaign of enforcement. I will tell you, I'll warn everybody here and everybody that lives up there, some of the tickets that we'll write are to your neighbors. That happens. It's not uncommon. As we can see the times of day and where we have the actual problems. We have limited resources. We can't sit on someone's street, obviously, night and day. But when I come back with the radar trailer, I'll be able to see if the problems are occurring at the commute or the school times. Then we can come and put our personnel right there at that time to make sure we are effective in all our enforcement. So we have a very well thought out plan for traffic enforcement there. And again, continue necessary enforcement based on violation patterns and, of course, citizens' complaints. So again, educate, once we get it, the survey approved, educate the public, gather some quick data, and that can be in a single day, and then get right out there and start doing traffic enforcement and target those times that are the most important. And we're ready to go, and we're just looking forward to the opportunity to have the survey approved so that we can get out there and do traffic enforcement. And with that, I'll leave it to my fellow staff members who will talk about the survey.
Good evening. I believe that the chief covered most of what I was going to talk about, because it's primary. Speed limits. If you don't do the survey, you can't enforce the posted speed limit, period. And this is actually a national standard. They do it per the 2012 MUTCD, which is the Manual and Uniform Traffic Control Devices for California. But the basics are performed everywhere in the nation. So if you go to Virginia or Florida, you're pretty much reaching the same conclusions everywhere you go. Now, the way this is performed is we take an unmarked vehicle and we situate someone out there with a radar gun, and they count 100 vehicles in each direction on a particular street. There has to be specific criteria in place. You cannot have traffic. You cannot have, like, the middle of an L.A. freeway. It's got to be clear moving traffic, no impedance. You can't have any kind of weather conditions or anything that would impede the flow of traffic. It has to be where people actually would feel comfortable. You also can't have any police enforcement out there while you're doing this. It has to be. And they do a graph to see where the average speed would be. Well, actually, it's the 85th percentile is the speed at which you would set the speed limit. That means 15 people are going faster, 85 people are going slower. And national surveys have shown this is the speed where people feel most comfortable. People go slower, you start reaching what the police chief said, you start getting road rage and everything else. So this has to be performed every 5 years, and it has to be certified by the city engineer, presented to the city council with a resolution adopted. So we got together with the police department, and we tried to determine which streets required a resurvey or which hadn't been performed. And what I have on the screen right now is 13 street segments that we had identified. Now, out of these 13, only four were targeted to actually have a raise in speed limit. And that was Fair Oaks from South Elm Street to South Halcyon. It's going from 25 to 30 miles an hour. Tally Ho Road, which there's probably a lot of people in the crowd about this one. Via La Grace Lane, which is a new road that didn't have a previous speed limit, would now have an established speed limit of 35 miles per hour. Now, a lot of this comes from, you do the radar speed survey on arterial streets and collector streets. You don't have to do it on residential streets, and that's where we get into Tally Ho. If it's a residential street, the prima facie speed is 25 miles per hour. But that's the whole thing, is you have to classify the street as a residential street. A local street, in order to have an exemption from the radar speed survey and have the prima facie speed, the roadway width cannot exceed 40 feet. It cannot have more than 1/2 mile of uninterrupted length. And it should have not more than one traffic lane in each direction. So when we go to Tally Ho Road, what actually happened, we tried to classify the road as a residential district. And there were certain criteria. In fact, I'll actually go to the next slide. I must have skipped the slide. It's defined by the number of structures that are within a quarter mile. So if you have 13 structures within a quarter mile on one side of the roadway, or on both sides of the roadway, you have 16 structures per quarter mile. You can classify it as a residence district. So we did have a legitimate speed survey on Tally Ho, but when we brought it to council, we tried to take that into consideration of the residence district and justify the speed limit at 25 miles per hour. So the documents that we had on hand used that exemption as 25 miles per hour, and the city engineer signed it off. Well, as soon as it went to the courts and people started getting tickets, they measured the width of the street, found that it was more than 40 feet, and he declared it a speed trap. So since we'd been through this road, we tried two or three different attempts to bring down the speeds. We decided to actually, we were going to do a new sidewalk project on Tally Ho, and we thought it was a good opportunity to try to put some traffic calming measures into the sidewalk project to try to bring the speeds down before we 27, I believe it was 45 miles per hour. After we did all this traffic calming, it came down to 35 miles per hour. Or what are we recommending here? Yeah, 30 miles per hour and 35 miles per hour. So it actually was effective. So when we brought the project to council, there was a few things that we implemented with that project. And one was we put a crosswalk on, well, I'll go to that later. The whole project was supposed to be trying to fill missing sidewalk segments on the south side of Tally Ho. So it would be a contiguous pedestrian travel from that section of town into the village. And we thought this was a prime opportunity to try to also get everybody north of the Tally Ho Jamesway intersection within the Highlands, so they also would have a continuous path to travel into the village. So that did justify putting a crosswalk at the intersection of Jamesway across Tally Ho. But in order to make that amenable to normal traffic standards, you really should have an all-way stop at the intersection. So we placed an all-way in the parking strip and the vehicle lane to make the lane widths 11 feet in width to try to just visually narrow the roadway so people would go slower. We also put up some digital speed limit signs that are solar powered, so they're actually very cost effective. We have had complaints they're in the wrong location, and we're working on that. But they have the digital readout telling people when they're exceeding the speed limit. You set it right at what the speed limit is. And these actually were effective. They've been in place for 2 years. They did bring the speed limits down 5 miles per hour on each of the segments. They didn't bring it down to 25, but they brought it down to 35 miles per hour. So that there are things that could still be done, but it would require considerable capital outlay and other future discussions. But at the moment, we cannot enforce Tally Ho Road at all if you implement the speed limit or adopt the resolution tonight. It would allow the police to actually enforce Tally Ho, which in theory could bring the speeds down more, because people know right now that there's no police enforcement or the people who are educated in that way. Housing projected for the north side of the roadway, and it falls less than the 13 per quarter mile. It also, there was the minimum distance of a half a mile for the length of the segment. It actually is just barely over. I think we measured it at 0.51 miles. So it does not meet that criteria, so then we have to treat it as a collector street, a residential collector. Now, there's been absolutely no stripes, anything on the roadway right now, and for a long time, there were no houses. I mean, they're just getting built now, and families are starting to move in. So we're taking this opportunity. We actually have drafted a project, and we wanted to get it done recently, but we got an outrageous price from the contractor. But it would actually do similar to what we did on Tally Ho. We'll put in a striping plan, put 11-foot widths on the vehicle lanes, define the edge between the vehicle lane and the parking lane on the north side of the roadway, put digital speed limit signs, which again are coming down in price, in each direction to notify people of the I, too, believe that the people have legitimate concerns about safety on their roadway, and we did listen to them at Traffic Commission. Again, we're bound by what we had to do with the speed survey and the vehicle code, but we believe that implementing these traffic calming recommendations and then possibly coming back in 2 or 3 months after that and doing a follow-up survey, which we could do again with Tally Ho, to see the effectiveness, and maybe the speeds will come down. No guarantees. This actually is a graphic of what we believe it would look like. You can see on the south side of the roadway is the creek, so you have the guardrail protecting. And that essentially completes my staff report. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions for Mike or the chief?
Okay, just for my own edification, I've talked to a lot of the neighbors, and I'm trying to understand some things. The idea of doing the survey means that you survey cars that are going. So if the natural tendency, because there has maybe should be.
Well, that could be opinion. I think we go back to what we were talking about before, that the survey assumes that people are driving in a normal and responsible manner.
Okay. But I'm big into statistics, and it just seems to me that the very lack of enforcement that's had to go on has to have some effect on human behavior, because we're saying just the opposite is true. By having enforcement, that is also going to change human behavior. So I just don't see how you can ignore it on one hand and say, but enforcement's going to make a difference. There's got to be an effect on both sides of the coin there.
I was just going to say, that's why we are recommending putting these things in place, and then we can come back and do another survey, because hopefully that will impact the speeds, and then a new survey may have a different result.
And then the next question is, and I think, Steve, you and I talked about this privately, is what are those things that might cause an exception legally to accepting the survey? And one of the questions that came up during my discussions with the public was, there's a bus stop that's on Tally Ho, and are there things on Tally Ho that could justify doing something different than the 85th percentile?
And actually, that's where we looked into the residential density, but it was thrown out by the road width. That was one exception that we could do. The other ones are senior centers. There was a senior center there, you would get an exemption, or a school. When children are present, you can come down to 25 miles per hour. You can also go by the accident history. If there was an excessive accident history there, it would alert you that there's a problem, but then it would probably be solved by other means other than just doing a speed survey. We do something with the roadway itself. But those are the major criteria. If you also had, like, let's say on James Way, we have quite a grade with a curve, so you got a vertical curve in the grade, you can use that as an exception. But Tally Ho is a pretty straight roadway.
So, like, Rodeo has, I think, speed bumps and bulb outs and striping. You're saying based on
also a residential collector, has a school on it, has a school bus stop, junior high bus stop, and right in the middle of it has a home for the severely disabled who are loaded directly on the street, and yet that speed limit is 35. Could it have been declared a residential? And I'm assuming there was a survey done somewhere in the last 5 years that, and people go 35 on that, probably a little bit faster. It doesn't have a particular accident history that I'm familiar with. I'm not looking to have Farrell declared a residential, but when you talk about the criteria, what's the? We see other streets similar to Tally Ho with 35 mile an hour speed limits.
Well, the spot that you actually had the senior facility, that could be signed for 25 miles per hour. But since it's longer than half a mile in length, Farrell itself, it doesn't really qualify for the residential district.
When you say half a mile in length, there are cross streets throughout it, so.
Right. And I think we're talking about the whole interrupted section. Okay. It'd have to be between stop sign to stop sign. They stayed the same.
Yeah, I know.
People still felt the same comfort level.
Yeah. So without question, it's parked cars that are the danger on Farrell. But okay, I just want to follow up. Thank you.
Well, I have a couple of questions. Company that did the speed survey, have we used them before?
No, we had not, but Pismo Beach had used them and had recommended them. We would have done the speed survey in-house like we'd always done before, but we didn't have the personnel available.
Okay, well, I'll get to that in a second. You mentioned that we measured Tally Ho and it exceeded 40 feet. How far did it
exceed? I believe it's 42. I think some places are 44, but I think it's 42 for the most part.
So in the speed survey, you have parking on both sides of Tally Ho. So theoretically, feet in certain circumstances. If somebody parked an RV there, same thing, right?
Correct.
So for roughly 2 feet, then this thing gets thrown out of the classification that you discussed.
Right, and when the traffic commissioner Sexton actually rendered his decision, he actually came out with a tape measure and measured himself, from what I understand.
I'll get to that, too. Okay. Chief, maybe this is a question for you. The reason why I'm having some trouble with this is, I spend quite a bit of time, and I'm sure everybody else spends quite a bit of time up on Tally Ho and on Grace Lane. And so we're proposing speed limits now that are the same as portions of Halcyon, which is two lanes in both. Through its entire length through the city is 35 miles an hour. That's two lanes in both directions. And then we have Oak Park, northbound from Grand Avenue, which is 30 miles an hour up to the top of the stop sign, and then 25 miles down the grade and the curve to 101. Those are the posted speed limits on those streets. And so, I'm having some difficulty here drawing similarities between Grace Lane, Tally Ho, and our major arterials that are now posted at what we're proposing for these two streets or less in the case of Oak Park. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, I think the best light I can shed on that is a couple of things. I'm not 100% sure on the Oak Park 25 miles an hour, but
it is.
Okay.
That's in Grover.
In Grover, okay.
Yeah.
But I will say that I understand your concerns. I understand. Feet versus 40 feet, a motorhome versus a car, all those things are valid concerns, but the vehicle code doesn't address that other than standard widths of vehicles. So it's a close one, there's no doubt. But we want to have the ability to enforce something, and I think that's the important part. I also look here at Tally Ho, and as much as we all remember the ones that are the 50-mile-an-hour people, which we all do, and I live not far from there myself. We have to remember, I'm looking here, the average speed at 32 miles an hour and the 85th percentile at 36 miles per hour. So in other words, The vast majority of people are driving at that speed, not the 50 mile an hour. And so in order to enforce this, we really just need to have the ability to go out there and do that. And the only way we'll do it is if we abide by the vehicle code and approve the survey. I look here at other places on Tally-Ho, 33 miles per hour as far as the average speed. And then I look on Grace Lane, and just to address a little bit of your question, you know, will they be going faster because they know there's no enforcement? Grace Lane's a perfect example. Not striped, not signed. This is, we have to start somewhere, and this will give us the opportunity. I can assure you that if we have the chance to go out and enforce, and I'm more than happy to see another survey done, because I don't want to be, we don't want our officers trying to enforce an unrealistic speed limit, but we have to start somewhere, and we have to be in line with the vehicle code so that we can do that. And so I will assure you and the residents here that once this is approved, we will be out there doing the enforcement. I'd welcome a second survey to come back on those streets to see if we have a significant impact on them. So I'd, hopefully that shedded some light on that question.
Thanks. All right. We're going to go ahead and open up this item to public comment. Anyone who would like to come forward, once again, please make your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward on this item?
Good evening, and thank you for your time in this matter. My name is Joni Fugit. I live at 200 Tally-Ho Road. Situation that is. I could agree that 30 may be appropriate for the road in some places, but I would like to point out that in front of our house in particular, it is a safety issue because there is a non-standard width road right there. I live on the even side, and on the odd side is where there is two properties that jut out and have not yet been made to the standard width. I suggest either keeping the speed limit to 25, and again, having to deal with the conundrum of not being able to enforce it, which is unfortunate, or making the necessary improvements to make the road a standard width at that spot. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
My name is Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I'm on the Traffic Commission. I was the lone dissenter on the Traffic Commission for specifically for two areas. Most of the speed survey appeared to be, the results appeared to be. And Prince Road intersection, we put up digital speed signs there about a year ago. They were put up in an inappropriate place. At the Traffic Commission, we suggested that those speed signs be moved to a more appropriate place before the speed survey was done, and that would help mitigate the speed of on that road. Unfortunately, they weren't moved before the traffic survey was done. I believe if they had been, then that portion of the road would have been much slower as far as the 85th percentile goes. The digital speed signs have certainly worked. The one that's up on James Way has certainly, from all apparent purposes, has helped reduce the speed down the hill from up around Kalinga area down to Tally-Ho. The other area that I had a problem with was Fair Oaks from Elm Street to Halkian. It's listed as a collector, I assume, because of the width. which is a couple of blocks. My biggest problem with the speed survey is it was done on June 28th. That's after school's out. Now, the speed survey cannot be done during rush hour, during school, ingress and egress, that kind of thing. But I'm here to tell you that people, there's a lot more traffic on that road during the school year, and people drive slower. So if that survey had been done during the school year, and I'm not talking during the hours that school would be let out or start, then that speed would have been slower. 9 months out of the year, that's a school and has school traffic. 3 months or a little less, it doesn't. So I think that that traffic study was done at an inappropriate time, and I couldn't support raising that speed limit, including on this, it said past the school. So those were the two things that I voted no because they were included in the motion. The speed survey itself was... The Stagecoach Road is 40 miles an hour. I looked at it today. It's listed there as being 45. In the documents here, it's listed as being 40 in one place on one document and 45 at the bottom on another place. That document was signed and attested to by the traffic engineer for this company. Besides that, there were just innumerable other mistakes throughout the report. Obviously, it was not proofridden by anyone at the where it was produced. They listed Grace Lane's daily traffic flow at 5,100 cars a day. I would be willing to bet that there's not 500 cars a day go down Grace Lane. It listed the length of road from James Way to 217 or 27 to Corbett Canyon as 1/600 of a mile. Part of the documentation here says they use the length of road as part of the criteria. So if they use this length of road as being 0.06 of a mile, did that skew the data? There just were a lot of other mistakes. I brought that forward, most of them at the Traffic Commission meeting. I think that the report was poorly done. And certainly there were areas of the report that were done at inappropriate times. I could say a lot more, but I don't want to go on past my 3 minutes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Council, my name is Bob Perez. I live at 264 Grace Lane. I'm not speaking in an official capacity. I had somebody come in and relieve me. I just got off an emergency, so I rushed over here so I could be here on time. The thing I'd like to bring to your attention, I think everybody received my email. Did the members receive? Okay. I'm just asking that you recognize that in resolution. ...26 spoke of striping and signing the bike lanes, bulb outs at each end of Grace Lane, and speed humps, distributed across Grace Lane. I don't know if that is in your plan, but it was listed as a condition of approval. So I would encourage the City Council to relook at that document if need be and seriously consider the conditions that you placed on the builder in your recommendation for the speed control on Grace Lane. Additionally, I'd like to point out that the speed survey, and I did speak with Mr. Adams and Mr. Lynn regarding that. I think the date of the speed survey was very inaccurate, being the 11th of July at 9 in the morning. That's not consistent with the average use of the street, and I'd like to see that looked at once again. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comment.
I'd kind of like to start with what Mr. Mayor Ferrara said in his response, was that, you know, we have to go with what the traffic, let's see, where was it here? The traffic commissioner sets out, and he's the one that sets the percentile rate, unless the city can make a compelling argument for it to remain where it is. I believe our compelling argument is safety, and particularly the safety of children. You've already pointed out that there are two bus stops on Tally Ho. There's a sidewalk only on one side, which means that people from the other side are going to have to cross to access that sidewalk. Sidewalk is used by children traveling from elementary school to the bus stop, or traveling all the way by foot to Paulding or Arroyo Grande High School. So this makes it, you know, a safety issue right there. And then I'd also like to ask that we could just revisit the issue of declaring Tally Ho a residential street. I think it needs to be looked at again. I don't know when he measured or where he measured. It does slow people down, in fact, but the problem with it is that they can't really tell why they're slowing down. There's no sidewalk. There's no, you know, there's just a pile of dirt and a house on top of it. You know, it looks like construction that's not finished. So we're used to it. We slow down. People who don't kind of careen around it, and then there's a house right there with children at the top of it. So that, I find it hard to believe that that is wider than 40, so perhaps if we measured it right there, we would qualify as residential. And then I'd also like to see if, because we have the two bus stops, can we get signs indicating that there are bus stops? I've noticed them in other parts of town, but I don't know what the requirements are for that. I guess you have to have an actual school to get the slow when children are present sign. Is that the case? But I have noticed for one on Wasna Road, there is a sign telling you that there's a bus stop on Wasna near where or Lopez, where it turns off to Wasna. Perhaps we can get a couple of those, and then it would remind people that there was a bus stop. I also agree with Mr. Ross. I was here for the traffic commission. So we had a pretty good chance, really, but we didn't have time to review the documents ourselves to see where they came up with this. We were all surprised on Tally Ho that they were actually going to raise it. That was astonishing to us, because that's going backwards from all the progress that we've made, and we thank you for your efforts on that. So I think maybe we need to look at a whole new traffic survey, because it was based on a bad time of year and a time when people were, like Mr. Brown said, not used to seeing any enforcement, so their speed had already gone up. Another concern I have with the 25 miles per hour is that we know people will drive 10 to 15 miles above. If you raise 25 to 35, that average speed is going to go up to 45. I believe the posted speed needs to be a safe speed, not a speed that everyone's traveling anyway. Thank you for your considerations.
Okay, thanks for your comments. Next.
Yes, I've lived there probably longer than most of everybody on that street, and I've been there when it was 45, 50, all. had side swipes, so the issue of the coming around that corner with no, you know, even like a stripe or something at the end of Tally Ho and Corbett Canyon, whether it was just yellow or white, just the people, the caution, because they come around 227 and they just turn up our street. And we've got new neighbors now that got two new babies. I have a granddaughter, and they just go way too fast. You know? So I hope they'd take that into consideration.
Okay, thank you for your comment.
I live at 370 Tally Ho, so I'm on the corner. And we do have sidewalks on my side of the street. The other side of the street, there's about two blocks without sidewalks. I see the kids coming down from like Prince. They get to Tally Ho in 227. They can't safely cross. They've got to walk in people's yards, walk in the dirt. I have to back out, and I'm on that corner. And people are, you know, it's kind of a blind corner if they're coming, like, down from Prince. And, yeah, they're going way too fast there. I've lived there for 8 years. I've never seen a police officer during the day writing a ticket. Maybe once. I do see police officers in the middle of the night stopping people. I have never once seen anybody during the day. And we have that corner across the street from me now. There's a house in the back with a child, a young child. The house in the front has two young children. And my neighbor next to them has a child. And then Aaron next to me has a kid. So there's four houses on this corner. There's not a stop sign for anybody entering this way. And the people that are coming this way, a lot of them are coming from Corbett Canyon and 227. They're cutting through. They're not taking the 101. They're cutting through from San Luis Obispo. So we have some really high traffic times when people are coming through. It's not our little local community that's speeding. It's the people that are coming using this as a cut through. And we did have a child in the village killed where the, I think it was killed a couple years ago. There's many concerns there. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to come forward?
Good evening. My name is Katie Merlot. I live at 224 Grace Lane. And I did send each of you an email regarding the speed on our street. I have three young children that I'm terribly concerned about. And I brought them to the Traffic Commission meeting with me. And my husband spoke at the Traffic Commission meeting as well. I am just concerned that the traffic study is not appropriate at all regarding our street. We barely just lived there a year. So I understand that the general public probably doesn't see people around during the day. They don't travel along that street at a lower speed because of that, and they believe that no one's living on the street yet. I mean, we even had some people approach our door not too long ago that thought it was still a model home. So I believe safety. I think many of our issues on Grace Lane, Tally Ho, is dealt with for a very long time, and I'd hate for our street to escalate the way that Tally Ho has. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments.
I'll be brief. My name is Carrie Peshman, and I live at 431 Cobray Place, which is just around the corner from Tally Ho. I've lived in that area for 25-plus years. I lived on Corbett Canyon. My parents live on Corbett Canyon. I live on Cobray. I use Tally Ho on a daily basis. My brother here lives on Tally Ho. He's one with a small child, and he has had his car, I mean, not his car, I'm sorry, someone else's car drive up on his property. Like I said, I've lived in that area for 25 years. I have seen speeds escalate. I live, when I come down Cobray, no, Gilardi, there's a blind corner. I have to constantly watch in my rearview mirror because people are speeding, and that's not your concern because that's county, but been presented, but I do want to reiterate that there were lots of errors on the report and that people do not drive safely. I feel like it's a matter of bad timing as far as the report was done too, and I don't remember why, but do you have any questions? Did I make myself clear?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good comments. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Ryan Ripley. I live on 391 Tally Ho, across the street from my neighbors here. And my consideration is also safety. I appreciate what you do and, you know, your time putting in for the city. I've also done that myself. I was on the fire department here for 10 years. And we had a mission statement, which was to protect the life and property of the residents of the city. And this is a consideration with this speed limit that I want you to, you know, seriously consider. And it's because I do have a child now, and we do come down to the village quite a bit.
Last chance. Okay, we're going to close public comment on this item and bring it to the council. And we'll start with Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, regarding Grace Lane, if in fact there are conditions of approval that the developer needs to do that can add to traffic calming, I think that needs to be looked at. Regarding the survey itself, I feel like my hands are tied somewhat. I am a little embarrassed that if we have to approve a document that's going to be used in possible legal proceedings with tickets later on, if there's proofreading that needs to be done and the document needs to just be cleaned up from a proofreading standpoint, it would be my hope that any motion that we made would include that any errors regarding speed limits, where they're incorrectly stated, or anything that's majorly wrong, that's material, that it'd be corrected prior to actual adoption, because I don't think we should adopt a document that's, that if it is in fact flawed based on lack of proofreading, that's kind of. Survey that from my perspective goes against what human nature is and doesn't really reflect what's actually going on the ground sometimes with neighborhoods. When they talk to you about those kids walking, doing what they do, I've walked that neighborhood over on Tally Ho and I know exactly what she was talking about. There's conditions that aren't covered by this survey that don't really reflect everyday human condition, and I think they should, that should be part of our thought process. That being said, I'm willing to approve it, approve the survey with the idea that we come back at some specific point in time that we determine now, 90 days, 120 days, whatever the appropriate time would be, and that we seriously consider redoing the survey, at least for portions of I don't know if we have to redo the whole survey or if we can just do portions, certain streets, because I don't think there's a lot of conflict over quite a bit that was done. It was just certain areas. So if we could narrow it down to just those areas, that'd be great cost-wise. And those are
survey. I just can't see us going back and redoing a survey, which is likely to come out close to the same. It might change some. It might be they pick a different day and they get some different results. But I think we would get significantly different results, or at least get the most honest result possible if we were actually in a position to do enforcement. I actually agree with the chief here that people drive at whether you consider it as safe speed, they drive at what I'll call a comfortable speed. As I say, I live off of a collector that has a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, and there's minimal traffic or minimal accidents in our area because people do, in fact, drive at a reasonable speed and do end up taking into account the kind of cross-traffic and the parked cars and all of those considerations that are part of that driving experience, I'll call it. So I think before we did another survey, we would certainly want to be in a position to do significant enforcement and see what impact that has. I'm not sure that I agree with the statement that if you set it at 35, then people naturally want to drive 45 or 50. They naturally want to drive at a speed. Probably going to find that with informants, the speed is going to come down some, but it's not going to come down a whole lot. But I do think we have to do the enforcement, and we have to see what impact that has before we do another survey. So I don't know what the timing is that's allowed between surveys. There's really, like I say, there's no point in just going out and doing another survey if we're just going to get thrown out by the traffic judge again. We've done this now for 4 or 5 years now, and for 4 or 5 years we're unable to enforce the speed limits that we're trying to set. So I believe we should increase it so that we can enforce it and then do the survey to find out what the proper speed is. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Ray.
Well, I just want to express maybe a little bit aloud that this is a really frustrating item for us because it seems counterintuitive what we have to do. And both the councilmen before me, of course, expressed that in different ways. But one of the residents came up and said, in a kind of a lament, police hands are tied as well. It doesn't do us any good to send our officers up on to traffic court either and having to try and enforce something we can't enforce and be declared, quote, incompetent or whatever the code said there. We've got much more important things to do, like public safety. Also, one of the residents talked about, pardon me, about making a compelling argument for safety. And unfortunately, it's not within this body's jurisdiction to determine what's a compelling fact. We have to go with what the vehicle code says is a compelling fact. And as frustrating as that may be, we need to, again, start somewhere. And so we can't, it's frustrating for us because too many people sitting in the audience and people maybe watching at home, it's one thing to base your decision on logic, and sometimes what we're restricted by via the vehicle code or anything else is sometimes not necessarily what you would deem logical. And I'm not trying to say that the vehicle code is illogical. I'm just saying that it feels like it's familiar with Grace Lane. And I completely get what the residents are saying. And what I want to do is I want to give Chief Anibale and his great department the tools they need to be able to keep our kids safe. And what keeps enforcement happening isn't a sign that says 25. What keeps enforcement happening is the police on our streets. And that's our primary means to be able to compliance, really. And we've proven that without that compliance, those numbers go up. And so we need to give them that tool so that we can make sure those numbers go down. On top of that, this is kind of a little bit of a lesson in math, that if you're talking about data and you're talking about averages, then if we give the police the ability to pull the 52s and the 55s out of the data, then that means the 25s are now going to really count. They're not going to get offset by the ones at the higher end. So if we really want this speed limit, for example, on Tally Ho at 25, then we have to take .35 is the end-all be-all, and not that we say as a city council that we believe 35 is the right limit. What we're doing is saying we're going to do 35 right now, and we're going to get this thing started so that we really can get it down to where we'd like it to be and where the logic tells us that it really does need to be. So with that, I'd like to also echo what Councilman Brown said, that I had exactly the same numbers here. I said that I'd like the council direction as part of going forward here to direct that we do a follow-up survey on selected streets from 3 to 6 months. So he said 90 to 180 days. We're in the same ballpark. Both of those time limits would put that before June, so that would keep it within the school year. And I think all of us as parents, I'm a parent too, we're driving, you know, our kids around, maybe doing more trips during the day than we normally do. So that would be an appropriate time to do a follow-up survey and also to take a look at that Tally Ho width and making sure that that's consistent across that Via La Barranca and James segment. I also would want to make sure that any motion we do today in preparation for another speed survey on Tally Ho, that we add not only bus stop signs, but that we add a sign going into the neighborhood coming off the curb and into the neighborhood coming off 227 saying you are entering a residential neighborhood or children at play or something that signifies this ain't the county anymore. You're entering our city. You need to slow down. And that in itself would be another measure. So I'd like to see that as part of our motion, not just the bus stop signs, which I think need to be there, but also an indication that you're entering a residential neighborhood. And that may also add to that level of reasonability that we know that we want drivers to drive with. So those are the changes. I'm going to support this tonight, but I just want the public to understand what my goal is as I'm supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Quick question for staff. Are we constrained at all as to when we can do another speed survey, whether we accept this one or not? And I assure you that your safety, your children's safety, is just as important to us as it is you're expressing it. I think the frustration level we have, as Councilmember Ray just said, we just can't enforce things right now. Ideally, we want to put a sidewalk in on Tally Ho. What's that going to cost? How long is that going to take? What, 2 years? A couple $100,000? That's not going to happen immediately. The young toddler that was killed here in the village, I think the truck that hit him was going 20. The speed limit was not the problem there. It's just it was a really unfortunate situation. A toddler can come out from your driveways, the same thing. God hope it doesn't happen. We have to establish a baseline here. I think Tim Brown was correct that by not enforcing things on Tally Ho, the speed limit has gradually moved up because we haven't enforced things out there, which then affects the survey, puts those numbers higher. But as Councilmember Ray just pointed out, once we start enforcement, once we start getting people that are going let's approve this tonight with the conditions that my colleagues have already mentioned about correcting any proofreading errors that are up there and making sure that the facts are correct. Let's get the tools in the hands of the police departments and we can start enforcement. Let's put some traffic calming measures in place on Grace Lane, and that's part of this proposal for us tonight. And let's resurvey these streets in the appropriate time fashion. And let's see if we can't bring these speed limits down as a result of enforcement. But I think it starts with enforcement. And right now, we just cannot enforce. Anything we do, if we don't approve this tonight and say, well, we're going to redo the survey, we're still putting ourselves another 6 months, 8 months out before we get back to this point again, where we'd approve a survey, start enforcement. I think starting enforcement as soon as possible is going to be the single most important thing we can do to start bringing the speeds down on these streets. So I appreciate your concerns. I hope that within the year we're going to see these speeds coming down. And when we revisit this, I hope we can bring the speed limits down a little bit more. But I think the first step is let's get the
I was pondering whether I should reject this, and I had several reasons why. And and as I was trying to make up my mind, I was driving just under the speed limit on Branch Street, and I got past the Shell station there at West Branch, and as I was heading right by the intersection there at West Branch, a few miles under the speed limit, a car decided they were going to try and make it across. You've all been that through that intersection. You know it's a challenge. Well, there was a car in the left turn lane, so I'm sure that that person didn't see me. But I'm estimating that I probably missed him by about a foot. And I had to swerve into the number two lane. Had there been somebody in the number two lane, I would have been very late to this council meeting. And had I been driving a few miles over the speed limit, I would have been very late to this council meeting because I would have hit that car. So, a couple of states. Number one, when people see a speed limit sign, they see the posted speed limit, and what goes through their mind is, okay, now that I know what the posted limit is, what's the limit that the officer is going to use to cite me? How fast can I push the envelope? And unfortunately, law enforcement, without the ability to strictly enforce those speed limits, will usually in their own mind, realize that there's a little bit of a cushion there, 5 to 7 miles over the limit. And I would also argue that that's the case today, that driving habits haven't changed that much, even though it's been quite a while ago. On the issue of other factors, and the vehicle code has been waved around, there are other compelling factors that can be made that can contrast the results of a traffic study. Unfortunately, the compelling factor tell you right now, this has been a pet issue with me for a number of years. This whole speed survey, 85 percentile thing, is not something that I am comfortable with, and I'm not comfortable with having those vague analyses and vague descriptions in the vehicle code continue to exist. If you look through that vehicle code, and this is sort of big picture, but maybe not, you'll see a number of sections in that vehicle code, and at the end, it will say amended and give a certain date. In other words, sections in the vehicle code are not cast in stone. Unfortunately, what's in there now, we have to live with until it gets changed. But I can tell you right now, I've had enough of this that, number one, I'm going to carry this to the Public Safety Committee and at the League of Cities, and I'm also going to talk to our assembly representative, Cacho, who now happens to be the chair of the local government committee in the assembly, which is a very powerful position. Should come out with a measuring tape and measure tally-ho, but I can guarantee you he didn't look around much while he was there, and that's troubling. The other thing that's troubling are all of the inconsistencies in this report that Mr. Ross pointed out, particularly the time that the survey was taken. That in and of itself, for me, would push me towards another survey right away, sooner than later. Because we're not just talking about Harlow School on Fair Oaks. And I agree with you 100% on that street. And I drive that street a lot. You know, it doesn't take too long to get from Elm Street to Alder. That street configuration doesn't change. And from Alder all the way to Halcyon is 25 miles. But during the school year, you might as well extend that school zone all the way to Elm, because it is crowded with school children on both sides of the street. So different ball game when this survey was taken. Now you can, if you look at tally-ho, you can throw Paulding in the mix. The logic that we're stuck with here, and it's in my mind questionable for all the reasons that I've stated, is that unfortunately, you know, we can't get to where we need to go unless we start enforcing, because there's no way we're going to get the laws changed in time for it to do us any good here tonight. So it is what it is, and with great reluctance, I'm going to move forward with this and vote for it with the idea in mind that we approach this the way everyone else has suggested, that this is not where we want to end up. This is not the end game. We need to get these speed limits down. I guess the other thing that's troubling, and I'm not a traffic engineer and I don't do traffic surveys, but in preparation of tonight, I spent quite a few hours up on Grace Lane, and I travel that way on occasion myself and am familiar with it. The 85th percentile, and I spent quite a few hours up there, all times of the day. I saw 25 to 30 going uphill, and I saw 30, and on occasion 35 going downhill. And that's been just the last few weeks. So I'm having some real trouble with those figures. So anyway, that aside, in order for us to make any material progress at all, we're going to have to get by tonight and get this thing moving. But in the meantime, those other things that I mentioned are also going to be moving, because this is, for me, this is significant enough to want to take some broader action, because this can't continue. You know, we keep spiraling up our speed limits based on the 85th percentile, and to me, that's just unacceptable. So, anyway, aside from that, I don't have any serious.
Was raised about the conditions of approval on Grace Lane, including speed bumps and the bulb outs. Obviously, we're going to do the striping. I am wondering, based on the discussion, because it's not a residential street, can we not do the speed bumps? Is that what I'm understanding? The second question after that.
Yes, when the subdivision was approved in 2004, there were some stock conditions of approval placed in the resolution, including a design speed of 20 miles per hour, and, or, excuse me, 25 miles per hour, and some language about consideration for traffic calming. Those, when once we got, you know, that subdivision map was extended for several years before it was approved. When it was approved, when the improvement plans were approved, as is often the case, certain constraints on the ground, including the drainage area and the slopes for the lots, created a situation where we approved some minor changes in the condition. Approval.
So, I do have another question. So, as a follow-up to that, if enforcement is unsuccessful, could we in fact install speed bumps if the drainage works?
I don't know that we could. I would look into that. I think that there would be an issue because of that, just because of the district designation, but also because quite clearly, when that subdivision was approved, and again when there were some minor modifications to that, the design of the home lots, as was stated in your staff report, were such that it was recognized that we would not have a street like in adjacent neighborhoods where we have people backing out, we have consecutive driveways in close proximity, and where people are backing onto the street. This was specifically designed so that people would face forward coming onto the Grace Lane. I would not envision, although I'd envision some narrowing of the striping considerations to narrow those lanes.
People to pull out forward?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. The second question I had related to this 42 feet. Now, we've heard testimony that at least part of the street is probably not 42 feet. What's the consideration? I understand the guy went out and measured, picked a spot, and measured the road. What is the consideration for what might be multiple sections where it's narrower than 42? Is it just that if it's 42 anywhere? Do you have any idea what the situation there is?
I think we'd have to get a ruling on that from our traffic engineer. Probably Omni Means, not the person that did the report.
Okay.
But on that. But it is relatively close to the stop sign. Generally between James Way and that obtrusion into the road generally do stay slow and then pick up speed after that. But once you get to the big curve, it's clearly marked, I believe it's 15 miles per hour or 20, to come down. But I think one of the theories is people are coming really fast up Corby Canyon, then they're supposed to slow down, then they hit a stop sign, and then they slow down further. So you're progressively getting them. speeds came way down, and I'm not witnessing people going 35 along that at all.
Thank you.
Did you have something else?
I was ready to make a motion, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to move that we adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Aurora Grande certifying the five-year radar speed survey for the selected city streets with the following modifications. That we proofread the portion of the resolution where it says, now therefore be it resolved, and just double check that the speeds there, that the only ones that are being changed or modified are the ones that were bolded in the report and that we intended to change. That we direct a follow-up survey to be 3 to 6 months after striping, and that we determine whether that's 3 to 6 months based on whether or not the survey will be done during the school year, so that we don't want to say it's 3 months if the striping happens in May, so that we time it properly. We install bus stop signs at the Lucia Mar bus stop areas on Tally Ho. And that we, lastly, on both ends of Tally Ho, I can't read that. Oh, thank you. That we, I'll get to that next, that we at both ends of Tally Ho add signs that say you are entering a residential neighborhood, or something of the sort, and that we move the radar sign that is on Tally Ho to whatever the Traffic Commission deems is appropriate. That concludes my motion, sir.
Okay. We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Well, I believe actually that we also had the Grace Lane traffic calming measures as part of the motion.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that wasn't in the resolution. So, yes, indeed, as described in the staff report.
Second holds.
Okay. There's a motion and a second discussion. That little cushion that I talked about between the posted limit and what is actually cited, I'm assuming that with this survey, with all of our ducks in a row now, that you can cite for anything over the limit.
We will eke it down as close to that cushion as we can.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? All right. Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Ray?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you all for sticking it out. Sorry we pushed it back a little bit, but appreciate you being here. Okay, we're going to move on to 11C. This is consideration of appointment of council members to regional and
represented on a number of regional committees and commissions that request that representation be filled by one representatives from the City Council. And after each election, we come to Council and ask that those appointments be made. Included in your staff report is the list of all the committees and commissions that are represented, how many members are required, and then who the current appointees are. And with that, like I said, I'll kind of turn it over to the council to decide what appointments you want to make.
Okay. Why don't we take this in order, which is typically the way we do it.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Tim, based on what I remember this is, if there's compensation, we're not allowed, are we not allowed to vote? Do we have to step down on the vote in which, on any committee that there's compensation, or is that what the 606 form covers?
That's what the form covers. That was the original determination by the FPPC, but then they decided they should have a nice form that discloses all the compensation, which purges you of all that taint, and so you can all participate now.
In here first. I'm okay staying with SLOCOG and the RTA. The city selection committee is typically mayors. I'll stay with that. The Sand District, according to the bylaws, are the mayor or the mayor's appointee. I'll stay with that. Five Cities Fire Authority, I'm the alternate for Joe. If he's okay with that, I'll stay as the alternate. The Briscoe Halcyon Interchange Subcommittee, that's sort of an ad hoc committee. We meet when we need to. And right now it's Joe and myself, and I'm assuming that'll stay the same. The Recreation Center Subcommittee, Steve, what do you suggest doing with that? At this juncture.
Oh, yeah, that's... be in March when they get back to us, whether they're going to proceed.
Okay, maybe we'll see what happens in March.
Yeah.
And...
Although you probably could dissolve it, because even if they move forward, most of the decisions and planning as far as the project's been decided, because they came to council and the project's already been approved. So I'm not sure there's really much issues left for the committee to be involved in.
You're the alternate. Karen, what do you think?
I think it's prudent to leave it till March until we get a decision from the body.
Okay. All right. So... everybody okay with that so far? Why don't we go with Mayor Pro Tem, Joe?
I'm satisfied to stay with APCD, as the alternate for Zone 3. Five Cities Fire Authority, Briscoe Halcyon, stay the way they are. I'm content.
Is that it?
I believe that's it.
The audit committee.
That's right. I'm on the,
the alternate.
I don't know that we've ever met. I've never had to sit in. So.
Okay. Because we have our resident auditor there. Okay. And you're okay with continuing on with all of that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Then let's go with Councilmember Ray.
Mr. Mayor, I am fine with the all my primaries. I am currently the primary for Zone 3 Water, for the EVC, for the CJPIA, and the Tourism Committee, and the South County Library Donor Recognition Committee. I am also fine being the alternate for the CAPSLO, and I really enjoy being the backup for anything Jim does, because he never misses anything, and the Recreation Center Subcommittee. So in short, I'm fine with everything as it's laid out here.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Brown.
No changes.
And Councilmember Guthrie.
seem to come together so with like four meetings in the same week. So if there's someone who would be interested in being the alternate on either of those, I would be interested in giving up one of those alternates just so I don't get, I'm alternate on a lot.
I'll take over any alternate position that needs to be done.
Why don't you do the...
Okay with both of them?
Yeah, if that...
Well, integrated waste, he's the primary. Tim's already the primary.
So I'm going to say if you'll take APCD as the alternate, I'll be happy.
Okay.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, did we get all that? Okay. You need a motion on this?
So moved.
All right. Well, we have a motion to reinstate all of us to the commissions and committees pretty much as stated.
With the exception of Mr. Brown.
With the exception of the, well, as stated. Councilmember Brown is now the alternate for APCD. Got that?
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, moving on to item 12, City Council Member Items. We have none listed. City Manager Items, none listed. Council Communications, any...
I have one quick, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
This issue of the in lieu fee that we talked about is a real issue for me, and I would ask that it be part of the work schedule to review it if, in fact, it's, because it doesn't seem to be in line with actual undergrounding costs, and so I'd like to see that worked on sooner than later. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any other? Go ahead.
Mine's just to feel good. I wanted to thank the residents of Arroyo Grande for coming out to the village on the elegant Christmas night when it was pouring down rain. I went out there in my high heels and pantyhose, got myself nice and wet, but it was wonderful. They constantly told me that they weren't sure anybody was going to come, and we couldn't even walk through the businesses. It was wonderful. Got a little Christmas shopping done. So I hope that that's encouraging enough to the businesses to continue doing that as a forever kind of thing. It was just amazing. So thank you, both residents and businesses, for such a lovely Christmas time event.
Okay, thanks. I mentioned to you earlier that I wanted to comment on some of the comments that were made during the community comments and suggestions, specifically the ones related to the sanitation district. And Mr. Broadwater, who gave that presentation, was here, and he did come before the sanitation district board and essentially presented the same report that he gave to us this evening. And what I wanted to do was, and what I will do, is provide you with the entire US EPA inspection report, because overall we received a was self-monitoring, and it was because one of the samples that the inspector observed was a sample that looked at fats, oil, and grease, I believe it was, and that sample should have been recorded in a glass beaker, and a plastic beaker was used in that one incident. So we got an unsatisfactory for the entire category of self-monitoring because of that incident. On the biosolids and the sludge storage deficiencies that that you have in front of you here, number one, we didn't even know that that the inspector was looking at that particular area. He didn't mention anything about it, didn't ask any questions about it, from what I understand. And so when the report came out, it was sort of news to us. The other point that I want to make is that this inspection actually took place last March. We were evaluated at the same time that the Paso Robles sanitation plant them a, from what I understand, they got a satisfactory rating. Their mitigation requirement was listed as a medium priority. We were given a generally satisfactory rating. Our mitigation for the deficiencies that you see in front of you were listed as a medium priority, not a high priority. Paso Robles, I'm not quite sure what was going on up there, but their mitigation requirements were given a high priority. So I don't know, something more serious up there, I guess. But the bottom line here is that inspection was conducted in March. We did not receive a copy of the U.S. EPA report until a few weeks ago. So it's been over 8 months. So if this were an issue of high priority, we would have gotten that inspection report, I suspect, a lot earlier. That said, US EPA did, from what I understand, give it to Regional Water Quality a few months after they did it, which they're required to do. Known that the inspector on site was going to ask questions or have some concern about the picture that you see, then we would have given him some additional information. The picture that you see that Mr. Broadwater took a picture of, that area is sort of known as our lagoon area. In other words, it's been in place to capture the biosolids that come out of the centrifuge. And it's stored there until it's trucked. And that practice has been going on for a number of years, probably 15 to 20 years. When that lagoon was constructed, there was a bed of red rock clay compressed in there, 2 feet thick. And when you see a picture of it, of the, and this was taken right after the rains, you see water puddling in that area, and that's a good thing. That tells us that the water is not soaking in, that it is pooling on top, which is why we call it the lagoon. When that water builds up, it's pumped from there into the headworks, back into the headworks. Mr. Broadwater actually suggested something that we're looking at right now. But on the issue of whether or not this is a serious deficiency, the answer to that question is no, it is not. This number one, if you look at our biosolids, and that's this graph that I passed out to you, you'll see that in just about every category, the biosolids that come out of this plant, out of the centrifuge, are pretty benign. And the reason why is because our area services mostly small businesses and residents. There's no big industrial sewage coming into our plant. So when you look at the environmental quality limit and you look at our readings on our biosolids in virtually every category, the only category where it is even close to the EQ limit is copper. Everything else is considerably less than what environmental quality stipulates. was that we truck this out, the pile of sludge that you see there, that we sell that. It gets mixed with other things, and they use it to, we sell it for fertilizer. So it goes back into the soil anyway. They use it mostly in the valley for cotton crops, and that's where we were able to get our highest price. So what Mr. Broadwater was suggesting was that we back a tractor trailer underneath that spout, and we catch everything so that it doesn't touch the ground, even though this area was designed for it to touch the ground. The only concern that we have there is, and we're working on sort of a workaround, is the weight of the truck may damage the compacted clay base that we put in there to prohibit or deter percolation. So what we're thinking about doing now is perhaps building that whole area up with some gravel. Hauling it once a week, haul it more often, and that way the weight of the truck won't be as great, which makes sense. So we're looking at that as a short-term fix. In our minds, it's mostly a cosmetic fix, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But when the after the rainy season, we will more than likely pour a concrete ramp there, and just have a truck parked there. That way, we can still do the once a week haul off. We'll just And the weight bearing or the weight of the load won't be an issue. On this particular situation, since there was in the report listed a potential for groundwater contamination, we did two things right after we got the report. Mr. Broadwater mentions the lagoon being in proximity to the Arroyo Grande Creek. So our plant superintendent and the staff at the plant tested the water. And the reading for nitrates was exactly the same. There was no change. The other thing that we did was a test for nitrates in, we have an on-site well that we use for irrigation at the plant. We tested for nitrates at our own on-site well, which is the closest water well there is to this lagoon area. And it came back non-detect, which means there wasn't a trace of it there. So we feel fairly confident that the practice that we've used has not, really led to any kind of a detrimental condition out there. However, more for convenience, if we can figure out a way to get a truck under there, that'll satisfy people who have concerns, number one. Number two, the yellow loader that you see in the picture there, we probably won't need anymore, or won't need to run it as often. So it'll dump straight into the truck. So anyway, that's the situation. I'll get you a copy.
Medium term kind of sensitivity, or is there any, what's their expected outcome from writing this report from us? What do they want from us other than some fix over some period of time? And the reason I'm asking is I'm worried about the whole fine issue. Is this somehow related to the way the plant's running and so that they're more sensitive to it, or is this just a normal course of events and fix it when you can?
No, I don't think there's any, I understand what you're saying, and I don't think there's any connection here to ACL and that issue. That said, what I don't understand is why it took so long for Regional Water Quality to send us that report. Now, I don't know if, and I'm not quite certain of this, but I think they didn't just send it to us. It went out to some of the media as well. So that piece of it, I think, was a little bit unprofessional, but we've seen that kind of behavior out of Regional Water. They went out to the refinery.
So as long as we correct the action in a reasonable period of time, there should be none.
Yeah, that's all that is required here. So anyway, any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, just real quick, I know at one time the centrifuge wasn't in place or wasn't working, and they did actually use drying beds. Don't they actually have drying beds available that do meet the EPA standard?
Yeah, it's just that when the center, this was actually at one point part of a drying bed where the centrifuge building was put in place.
Maybe that's what I used to
say. So it's essentially the same, because those drying beds have the same clay.
The drying bed is exactly the same. So the EPA wasn't really looking for anything more. They just didn't know what they were looking at.
No, they didn't know what they were looking at.
And my second question is I'm struck by the spike in copper. Are you guys following up on that? I mean, that's almost double what it, triple what it was the year before.
Yeah.
Are you guys following up on that anomaly? I mean,
I haven't asked. So, okay, any other questions? All right, then moving along, any other council communication? Staff communication, anything, Steve?
Nope.
Final community comments and suggestions, anyone?
Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street, and this is in regard to the mayor's comments regarding your lagoon. In the past, I was a surveyor. I did a lot of work for the Corps of Engineers as a contractor, not in the Corps of Engineers. And one of the things we did was do a lot of basins and things like that, and you're absolutely correct. A good, solid clay base can be very moisture containing, and you can really stop a lot from going on. The only problem with clay bases is that they have, over a long period of time, they can have some susceptibility to natural those are very hard to detect until you get leakage. In some cases where we did that kind of, found those kind of problems, they came in and put in extremely heavy-duty, basically pond liners that were designed for that, although I understand that is very expensive and carries its own drawbacks. But that would be one thing to think about, is that there can be some compromise to a clay layer, as good as they are, by some rarely occurring incidences. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Then that takes us to item 17, and we do have a closed session item this evening. So at this time, council is going to adjourn to closed session, and we will report out of closed session at the next regularly scheduled council meeting. So council is adjourned to closed session at this time.